Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Welcome to Nerds Podcast number 864. This is the first Nerdist, this is going to be a little confusing, but you're all smart people, so I feel like your brains will be able to absorb this quickly and easily. This is the first Nerdist podcast that is actually the full unedited audio of Talking with Chris Hardwick, guest Elijah Wood, our very first episode. I hope it's a good idea to, it feels like it's a good idea to do this, Katie, to post.
I think so. It's unedited.
It is unedited. So it's like, you know, so much of the conversation gets cut out to like, to slap it into a 41-42 minute time crunch. And, you know, I think it's kind of interesting to hear what gets cut out or how stuff was moved around to make sure that the conversation flowed, but so you'll hear some differences in the unedited audio, which I just think is fascinating if you have any interest in broadcasting or how media works. But nothing was ever edited in a way that changed what a conversation was.
Yeah.
Things may have been moved around or cut down, but it wasn't like, okay, we took one sentence from one thing and pasted it with another sentence from another thing to create the false illusion of a third idea. It just kind of gives you some backstory about how things are, you know, cut down and edited for television. So watch the video version, please, so I can continue making them. Please support that. And then also you can listen to the unedited audio here. And then, you know, if you're sitting in traffic or on a treadmill or at your job that you are not super enthused about. But Elijah, who was just on the Nerdist podcast not that long ago, but I still learned stuff about him that I didn't know before. And he's just such a great guy and such a wonderful conversationalist and really smart. So it was great to have him on and an honor to have him as the first episode of Talking with Chris Hardwick, which airs Sunday nights at 11 p.m. on AMC. And then we're finding out where else digitally that will be available for you as well. He is promoting I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, which is a fucking great movie if you haven't seen it. Did you watch it?
Yeah, I
Melanie
loved
Linsky's
it.
In it, who is just so – she's such an incredible actor.
Yeah.
And they are fantastic together. So check that out. That is on Netflix right now. And if you want to watch full episodes online and get more show exclusive of Talking with Chris Hardwick, go to amc.com/talking. Here's Nerds Podcast number 864, Talking with Chris Hardwick with Elijah Wood and Katie Levine. Roll it.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Tonight on the program, my guest is an accomplished actor who got his start at 8 years old when he was basically just a pair of big eyes. And you probably recognized him and stuff. Didn't even know it was him. He appeared in countless films before he started traipsing around Middle Earth with a bunch of hobbits. He spent a lot of time bonding with a human-sized dog named Wilfred and is currently prepping for his season 2 return, playing the reluctant assistant to the holistic detective, Dirk Gently. I've known Elijah for a handful of years. He's a terrific human being. He's always immersing himself in amazing creative endeavors. For instance, he's a co-founder of a film production company, Spectrovision, which is creating a
a space for horror films, which push the boundaries of what horror can be. He's a horror fanatic. It's turned me on to a lot of great horror. He's half of a music-loving duo called Wooden Wisdom, who get to travel the globe DJing. And his latest film, I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, got the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance. It is a fantastic movie. I just saw it. It's on Netflix. You should watch it. Tonight, Elijah Wood is talking with Chris Hardwick.
Excellent.
And we're back from the intro. All right, so you, the fans, you've reached out to us in droves, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, using @talking. So I'm going to be chatting with Elijah. I'm going to kick off the conversation, but then we're going to weave in your questions and comments, your quements, if you will. We're going to show you some video messages that you sent in for Elijah Wood. Plus, people here in the studio audience, you're going to get them. People here in the studio audience are going to get a chance to ask question Comic-Con style. But first, it's my turn, so let's get started. As I said in the intro, you've been doing this almost, I think you almost started fetally in the business. Is that not true?
I started when I was 8. I'm 36 now, so what is that? That's a long time.
That's 28 years ago. 28 years you've been doing this.
It's been almost 30 years.
Yeah, that's nuts.
That's weird.
I know, it's weird.
I've never thought about that. That's really disturbing.
This is where we broke Elijah Wood, because he just realized, oh my God. That's like when your grandpa would go, yeah, I got a watch. I worked for 28 years, and they gave me a gold watch. Yeah.
And now I can say things like that.
Yeah, where's
Except
your
for the
gold
watch? I know exactly. Yeah. Where is my
You got a gold
watch?
Ring. You got a little gold ring there.
That is true.
But so the first time, and I didn't realize this was you, is the, and I don't think you guys realize this because you're all millennials, but but back in the 1900s, there was a former show host named Paula Abdul who was a musician. And she had a video called Forever Your Girl.
That's right.
And you were in that video.
That's right.
And who was the director of that video?
David Fincher.
How crazy is
it's
that?
So crazy. That's before he started making movies.
Before he became David Fincher.
That's right. Yeah.
Do you remember anything about that video?
I do. I mean, I remember meeting her. She was a big deal at the time, so I was super excited to meet her.
Yeah.
I was on a film set for the first time, so it was all kind of surreal. I just remember being really excited. I play a young executive in the thing who's like distraught, presumably over like a broken relationship. So I'm sitting at a desk and I like break a pencil in pain, and I run my fingers through my hair and look out the window, like really kind of heavy, distraught thing for an 8-year-old experience. Yeah. And to sort of try and convey.
I'm gonna guess the relationship didn't work out because you were 8.
That's exactly
Paula Abdul was considerably
older. You are too young for
me. You're too young for this.
Yeah.
I should have realized this before we started dating, but now it's gonna have to end. Do you feel like you broke up with her or she broke up with you?
Ooh, wow. I sort of feel like he broke up with her, or I broke up with her.
Yeah.
And then regretted it.
Gotcha.
That's just my 36-year-old brain telling my 8-year-old brain that that's what it is now.
You know, I'm going to...
Although that may not have been my motivation
maybe,
at the time.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say, I think you could probably get it back. I think maybe now is the time. Paula Abdul's here, everyone! No, I'm kidding. Wouldn't that be amazing?
That would be amazing.
But so how did you get involved in this, in the video in the first place? Was acting something that you wanted to do, or was it just kind of an accidental thing?
So the story kind of goes, I was born in Iowa, raised there. My mom saw a commercial when I was around 5. And she saw this commercial and she thought, Elijah has a lot of energy. This would be a really great outlet for his energy. But there was no kind of outlet for that in Cedar Rapids. So she put me in modeling school, which was kind of the closest thing to acting, I suppose.
Sure.
And so I actually did some, like, runway modeling at malls, at local malls. And I did some, like, print photography work as well. I actually have photos of myself, like, walking down a runway in a mall with, like, sunglasses on and, like, a bathing suit sort of situation.
Nice.
Shorts.
Sure.
So I did that for a bit, and then that particular school did have, like, an acting element to it. So it would do, like, monologues, things like that. My brother, who's 7 years older than me, had a vested interest in acting. He was doing it in school. Also went to the same kind of modeling school, and then they ended up going out and representing some of their students at a thing in L.A. called the IMTA, which is the International Modeling and Talent Association.
Okay.
So I went out there and, like, competed.
Competitive modeling?
Well, it was... there were all these different categories. It's so bizarre to think about now because it's so long ago. But one of the things that... One of the competitions was like a singing competition. So I actually sang Don't Worry, Be Happy. Is anyone familiar with that? Which is a Bobby McFerrin
song. Yeah.
It was a big deal at the time. This is 1988. And so... The story behind that's kind of funny. I went out to sing it, and the people were clapping so loud that I couldn't hear the backing track. Mm-hmm. So I, like, lost my way, and which was the most embarrassing, horrifying thing ever. And I had to try and find the rhythm again, and I never quite found it. But they gave me an honorable mention because I just stuck.
I just stuck with it. Yeah, like, he gave it the shot.
I'm stick with it.
He was in it as much as he could possibly be in it.
Yeah. So while I was there, I met a talent manager who asked me if I wanted to be an actor. And I'd never really thought much about it, but the idea of...
Well, you hadn't thought much about anything. What are you, six at the
time? Exactly. I was seven.
You were seven.
But the idea was thrilling. You know, moving out to California, I was so excited about being in California for the first time. And so we were like, why don't we just come out to L.A. for 5-6 weeks, go out here to audition, get an agent, and see where it goes for fun. And then within the first 6 weeks of auditioning, I got this Paula Abdul job. And I did a number of commercials, and then... I got a role in Back to the Future 2.
Oh, I remember Back to the Future 2. You're one of the little kids where he's playing the game that's kind of based on Duck Hunt, but he's shooting the thing.
Exactly.
And the other kid goes, that's like a baby's toy.
Totally.
Yeah. But that should have been your line.
It should have been my line.
What was that like working with Zemeckis at, you know, 8 or 9 years old?
I don't remember Zemeckis, honestly. I do remember Michael J. Fox. I was a huge fan of the original film, and so being on that set was completely mind-blowing to me because I knew that film, and I knew it's Hill Valley, right, the name of the town. So I knew the town architecturally from the original film, so seeing it in the future was crazy, seeing all these futuristic cars. I mean, it was a proper giant film production, and I was this little child that was in some sort of fantasy land. It was amazing.
Did you ever talk to Michael J. Fox again, like, years later? Did he remember?
I never met him again.
Really?
I never met him again, no. I'm a huge fan of his, though. I think he's extraordinary.
So what happens after Back to the Future? Because what I feel like is happening now is Elijah Wood is taking hold of Hollywood, and Hollywood is saying, hey, Elijah Wood, with those steel blue eyes, look like they were scooped out of the crust of Superman's home planet, Krypton, and just those glowing blue orbs that you have, which is so easy to get lost in. What's happening? Like, is it your family saying, okay, I guess we stay here now and we make a go of this? Or
that's essentially what happened. Like, after getting a couple of jobs, it seemed like a sustainable reason to move to California. And I think my mom also wanted to broaden our horizons and move the family out to another place that wasn't Iowa anyway, just for new experiences. So my dad and my sister stayed in Iowa while we kind of, like, got things situated, and it seemed like a reasonable moment to move because I was working. My brother also was starting to work as well and doing commercials. So everybody moved out here. And within that first year, I got a couple of roles in films, Back to the Future 2 being one of them, and a small role in Internal Affairs. And then I did a movie called Avalon, which was sort of first...
It was Barry
proper
Levinson.
Role, Barry Levinson, exactly. Mm-hmm. And it was the first proper role I had in a film with actual dialogue and a kind of character arc. And I loved it. It's a bizarre thing to think about now because I'm so deep in it and I'm an adult and I have a life that has sprung from this. But at the time, you know, I was a child kind of going with the flow and sort of always loving it, and I kind of came up and learned how to do what I was doing because I didn't have any training.
Sure.
It was all kind of instinctual and, and I kind of learned as I went, I suppose.
Well, I apologize because I assume this is a question that you must get all the time, but it's so, I'm always fascinated by people who grow up in the business, like from childhood, and when they...
It's not advisable.
When they... yeah,
it often doesn't work out
No,
well,
I know that's true, but, you know, the fact that you didn't, you know, like, nosedive into a pot full of crack is, like, a great... You know...
Because they're everywhere.
I'm just always, like people who... Because it's tough enough to make it through youth and teen years, like, not being in this business around the sort of the plasticine sheen that is this town and everything that involves it. But the fact that, you know, you grew up
just such a like a normal, nice dude with, you know, good values, and, you know, you're nice to people, and I don't know, it is a tremendous accomplishment. So how did you not implode?
It is weird that being nice, because I hear that a lot, like, you're just so nice. As if that is an accomplishment.
It really
is. It's just
kind
of how you're supposed to be.
I know that. And for most of America,
right.
But, you know, we're in such a crazy bubble here.
We are. We're in a weird industry. I mean, I credit all of that to my mother, who I think was very conscious of the fact that I could and ultimately did endure a great deal of attention. And I think she immediately saw where that could go, that, you know, I could overly define myself by what it was that I was doing or the perception of who I was, or special treatment. Like, she never let me accept special treatment. That was a huge thing. She drilled humility into me, provided a very real sense of life outside of the work that I was doing, and never really allowed for me to overinflate my sense of importance. And since I had that from such a young age, that became who I was. So I always had perspective.
Yeah.
She provided perspective and a sense of that's the work that you do, and you also have a relatively normal home life that is totally separate from this weird industry that you're in.
But did you go through a period of, I mean, it's an exceptionally difficult business,
which is
not only attracts a certain personality type that can skew a little insecure and need for attention, you know, being performers. Mm-hmm. But then also, that's completely preyed upon by a business that is, you know, just wrought with rejection and judgment and and harshness and, you know. And so did you ever experience a period of, oh, God, I'm not really working, or I'm getting really close on stuff? Like, did you ever feel like lean periods, or maybe I'm not doing the right thing? I mean, was that something that you had to navigate?
Definitely. And that kind of happened post Lord of the Rings, actually.
Really?
Yeah, a little bit. I think I look a lot younger than I am. So do you. And I think that that's... It's true.
I'm sorry. I don't look any younger than 29, my age.
It's true. I'll never forget being at Comic-Con with
36.
You.
36. What an old man over here. Right, you guys? Boy, you get a rascal for this guy to get around. Not like me. I'm millennial. Go Fetty Wap. My references. What happened at Comic-Con?
We had a panel, and I thought you were a lot younger than
you did.
You are. And you were like, dude, I hosted Singled Out. I was like, oh, yeah. I forgot.
I don't know what he's talking about.
What are you talking about?
He's clearly got it. Oh, yeah, that was a Hobbit panel.
That's right.
It was the Hobbit panel, and you just happened to be there.
Yes.
And you came out. I had a very strange experience with Ian McKellen there.
What does that mean?
Well, it was... Let's all just get our minds out of the... I mean, don't get me wrong. I'd fuck the shit out of him, but I just... It wasn't that. I really would. He's a legend. But you know, we're out on the panel. We're in Hall H. Hall H is 7,000 people. You know, it's an incredible experience if you've never been in San Diego. And you know, he was so charming on the panel. And yes, of course, oh, good times. And so then I do that thing mistakenly. I'm moderating the panel. I think, oh, we're friends now. You know,
yeah.
I can talk to him. So backstage, we take the picture of the panel. And then I turn to talk to him. And then at that point, sorry, my pant legs. At that point, I think, oh, we're buds now. So I go, oh, my God, Ian, it was so great to get a chance to... And then just he instantly was just shut off, and he goes, yes, right, and then just walked away.
Oh!
And he totally royaltied me, and understandably so, you know, fine. But it just caught me off guard. I was like, oh, man.
Oh, no.
We're not going to be on a yacht clinking glasses.
Oh, that's a shame.
It was, but everyone seemed, in general, everyone seemed pretty great.
And he is great. He is great. It may have been that they were rushing him onto another thing.
They weren't rushing him.
He was.
He sauntered off very slowly. He just needed to be somewhere else.
Oh, yes.
Yes, right. Yes, right. It was just like as high as a person's chin can be in the air.
He's a very humble person. He's a lovely human, but maybe. I don't know.
Listen,
I'm making excuses for him, but
no, it's fine.
But it's true.
Listen, next time you guys talk, if he asks about me, tell him I've just recovered.
Yeah, I will.
You tell him I'm doing A-OK. But I know this, you know, a lot of people have Lord of the Rings questions. For you, what was part of the experience? You got to go to the Oscars.
Yeah.
And, you know, was that strange?
So surreal. I mean, going to the Oscars, I'd never been before outside of presenting something. So the notion of being there, especially on the last film, when we were all there together, and to be there and see all of these incredible people who were a part of making those films come to life, one after another, accept these awards, was just completely surreal and extraordinary.
Do people come up to you that freak you out? I mean, you know, like really famous people come and go, oh my God, I know who you are and I love this movie.
I'm always freaked out by that. I mean, I still get freaked out by meeting people that I admire. So, always.
I thought, maybe, I can't remember if you told me this or I heard this, that
the Jack Nicholson
story? Thing?
That's amazing. Yeah, I had a conversation, that's very surreal. I had a conversation with Jack Nicholson where he said, I'm not going to do the impression, but he said he loved the film. And he's like, but there are too many endings. He's like, I left after the first ending. He's like, I just couldn't. It just went on and on. It's great. It's
How
a great movie.
How do you respond to that?
And I was like, well, Jack, that's the book, man.
Yeah.
Like, they had to tie up all these stories.
Peter Jackson, where are you? Peter, I need help. You need to bail you out.
Amazing.
Lord of the Rings reactions. This is from reactions from around the internet. At June Booga J says, Elijah Wood was the heartthrob of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, right? Or am I remembering that wrong? Move over, Orlando Bloom. Real Anavu on Twitter says, if I go to see Elijah Wood's DJ set and he doesn't remix Lord of the Rings theme, I'm going to be disappointed.
You're going to be sorely disappointed. It'll never happen.
I feel like she'd still be okay. Amelia Devine says, more been watching Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit for about the fifth time, and I still love you guys. Elijah is bae. That's just some of that terminology that us millennials like to use.
Yeah. It's true.
Wait a minute.
I'm just baying all day.
All day long. Dominic Monaghan said, you have to ask Elijah about the time he farted coming down the hill. And I don't know what it was. That's all he said. He said that you would fill in the gaps.
Yeah, so first day of filming Lord of the Rings, it's the four hobbits rolling down the hill, landing on the wooded road, and then hiding behind the tree as the ringwraith come by.
Yes.
So we did that over the course of 2 days. And the first thing we did was like rolling down the hill. And on one, either on a take or in a rehearsal, we rolled down and just, it was an impact fart. It was a pure...
One of those.
You know, like... Yep. Instant. Yeah. And it was loud and everyone laughed and... The fart heard round the Shire.
I mean, that experience, you say you've been acting for 28 years, but that, you know, how many years of your life was Lord of the Rings?
It was four, all in all, four. We shot, the principal photography was over the course of 18 months. So we lived in New Zealand shooting all three films at the same time, which is a Herculean effort. I mean, there were literally six or seven units concurrently shooting.
Right.
To make sure that we could finish it all. And then we went back every year for each individual film as they were kind of cutting them and putting them together, and we would shoot additional footage as they were kind of fine-tuning and tweaking. So we actually had the opportunity to kind of go back and fine-tune and tweak each individual film. So 4 years of our lives were those movies.
I mean, it's hard to imagine, but the 90s... were still a rough time for film, and then coming into the early 2000s, even hearing, well, they're going to do Lord of the Rings. What? How are they going to do that?
Yeah.
Because films just weren't made on that scale with that many effects. But then, you know, all of a sudden, around the same time, you have Sam Raimi's Spider-Man, you have Bryan Singer's X-Men, you have Lord of the Rings coming out, which really...
Harry Potter,
yeah. So you have all these films that are effect-heavy, these epic movies that not only change the way film is made, but also...
Not necessarily for the better.
Not always.
Not always.
Not always for the better.
Yeah.
But elevated, you know, our subset group of nerddom into more of mainstream culture.
And that's very true.
And that all happened around the same time.
And it sort of, it broadened the scale and scope of Comic-Con as well.
Yes.
And nerd culture in general.
Yes.
Which is really kind of exceptional. I'd not really thought about that, the timing of all those things converging.
Did that bother you? Because it does bother some of the proto-nerds that Comic-Con, like to say Comic-Con is like, well, it's not really about comics anymore. And it's like, it's about pop culture and there's more fringe people. And I always just kind of feel like, I always feel like, well, that's good. It's more inclusive. Does that bother you that it's so pop culture driven now?
I wasn't a Comic-Con devotee prior to going there for Lord of the Rings. So I wasn't a comic book collector or someone that was a purist that could be upset about it. But yeah, I mean, it's always a little bit upsetting when you see, I mean, you see this at film festivals too, where giant TV networks are bringing their things to film festivals, and you're like, well, what place does it have at a film festival?
Right.
You know, there's definitely a sense of the big corporate machine kind of jumping in and capitalizing on fandom.
Right.
But at the same time, it's all about generating positivity and excitement over the things that people mutually love. So, I don't know, it doesn't bother me. I think it gets a little corporate, and there's a lot of money being thrown at it. But at the end of the day, it's still a place for people to be who they are and express themselves. That's
sure.
The part of Comic-Con that I love the most, that it's, you see people that have been working on cosplay all year, and there they are able to express that thing that they're interested in, and it still works for them. And as long as that spirit is there, you can't destroy what makes Comic-Con special,
and
I think.
Have you ever had your mind completely melted out of your head seeing a Frodo cosplay walk up to you and go, hi, I'm you? I mean, that's so strange.
That is strange, but it's also, but wow, what a laugh. That was so good. It is strange, but you know what's, it's funny being a part of something like Lord of the Rings, what you immediately accept as a part of the new reality.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, like, I'd never been a part of a film that had a giant billboard on the side of a building, or we were on sides of planes.
Yeah.
That was ridiculously massive in terms of scale and promotion, but it's amazing how quickly you can compartmentalize that and be like, well, it's a part of this thing.
Right.
So, to that point, like, going to Comic-Con and seeing someone dressed as Frodo didn't really freak me out, because it's all within the context of that sort of thing. What freaks me out more is the more obscure things. Like, I did a miniseries, an animated miniseries called Over the Garden Wall for Cartoon Network.
Mm-hmm.
And I see people dressed up as those characters, and I think that's awesome.
That's insane, yeah.
That's fucking insane.
Yeah.
That's a thing that is, you know, it is popular. They show it every year, but it's also to its smaller audience.
Right.
So to see people dressing up as those characters, I'm like, holy fuck.
Well, yeah. Well, you know what's great about
that's
that,
awesome.
Too?
Or Wilfred, too.
Or Wilfred, yeah. Too, for instance. But but what's great about it is that, you know, like those sort of, and kind of looping back around, that's why I say to people, like, you don't ever need to be upset that nerd culture is being too co-opted, because there are still niche trenches
always
that the truest nerds will be the only ones with the diving gear to swim down to.
It's true.
You know? The people who cosplay as that or something really, 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 really specific, like, there's room for everyone.
Totally. And the bigger that Marvel and DC and Disney get, the more these things will be expressed as well. Because that stuff is so fucking covered.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's hard to be, even if you were a pre-existing Marvel fan, I would imagine. I wasn't a huge Marvel fan, but it's hard to be a fan when it's just so covered for you.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's more fun to get into things that are a little bit smaller and obscure and strange and express things that aren't being expressed on the widest scale.
Yeah, sort of like, you know, well, yes, everyone loves Star Wars, but, you know, my favorite droid is R5-D4.
There you go.
So, you know, it's like, yeah, I know everyone loves R2-D2, everyone loves C-3PO, but, you know, I love the failure droid. Like, he's my favorite.
He's awesome. My favorite droid is it... DB-88?
What, BB-88?
BB-8? Yeah, that's it,
yeah.
BB-8.
Yeah, BB-8, the little soccer ball.
Oh, no. What's the one I'm thinking of? He's also, he's a droid, but he's a bounty hunter. Tall, IG-88, so I knew it was an 88.
I'm really surprised someone in the audience knew the answer to that. And just people like,
thank
it's
IG-88! It's IG-88!
God damn it! Don't fucking, I used to love you, Elijah Wood! Why can't you know stuff that I know?
I was close.
That's sort of like, you know, the best way to fuck with nerds is to... It's just those pictures. You know, they do those incorrect mashup pictures. So it'll be a picture of Patrick Stewart and then a quote that says, use the force, Harry, Gandalf, you know, but it's Patrick Stewart. When Lord of the Rings finally wrapped up after this epic experience for you, what was, you know, saying goodbye to it? I mean, it was such a significant part of your life. So how do you say goodbye to that?
It was really hard. It was really hard. I mean, we had become a family over the course of making them. I often say that it was like making the world's largest independent film because we were tucked away in New Zealand. And the thing to remember, too, is this is really pre-internet. It was internet times, but the sort of fervor by which there are multiple fan sites associated with this thing.
Pre-social media, too.
Totally. So there weren't eyes on us the way that there are eyes on things now. So we were very much in our own world, and there's very much a kind of Kiwi ingenuity of everybody just kind of does multiple jobs to get the job done. So there was this great sense of it feeling small, even though the scale was big, and it was extraordinary. And we all became the best of friends and had an unbelievable journey that was unlike anything we'd ever experienced. And then, you know, the principal photography ended, and that was really hard. But then we were like, oh, we get to go back every year. So we went back, and we kind of got lulled into this false sense of security of we're just going to be doing this forever. And it was the last time that we went back that it became real for us, that we wouldn't ever kind of be there under these auspices again and work with these people in that way. And it was very hard. It was hard as well to understand what your life meant again. So, you know, when you spend that much time working on something, which none of us had, I'll never forget getting home the first time, actually, after principal photography, and kind of not knowing what to do with myself. You know, when your life is essentially scheduled and you've got this responsibility of bringing this character to fruition over the course of a year and a half, and then you're just dropped off at home. I was like, I don't know what to do. I didn't know what my daily life was. It was a very bizarre, unsettling feeling because it was our life. You know, we all had houses there. We had routines outside of the work that we were doing on Lord of the Rings. So, and I was 18, so I came up in, you know, in some ways it sort of felt like a tour of duty or going to university potentially in the sense that that's the time that you go away from home and you have this formative experience. And that's what that was for me. So to leave that, especially at that age, was confusing and hard to deal with. It took me about 6 months to wake up. I was that tired, too. Like, seriously, like, so exhausted, because we were working 6 day weeks for a majority of the film.
Wow.
16, 17 hour days, and that was the kind of bulk of it. So getting home, I was like, yeah, I was dead on my feet for a while.
But you also said when you got back that there was a kind of a strange period where you felt the gap of, oh, am I not going to work anymore? What's going on? Am I just that guy? Who am I? Who am I? And what am I? Especially at the age you were at, too, that's what you do naturally. But you really have your identity tied to what you're doing in a career. And so how did you navigate that?
I was very cognizant of it, that those films were going to be the primary thing in people's purview for a long time, certainly 3 years. I remember feeling I immediately wanted to do something really small. For two reasons. One, it would take half the time or even a fraction of the time.
Yeah.
The idea of doing something massive on a large scale was something I did not want to do just because I'd come from something that took all of my time. And then also something small and intimate so I could just do different work that was completely different to what Lord of the Rings was. And that is sort of how I went for a while. And in terms of that identity, I always felt like, as long as I continued to work and do things that were so different from Lord of the Rings, explore different characters, continue to challenge myself, I'd be able to keep working. And it wasn't until I was sort of in my mid-20s that I actually had about a year and a half where I didn't work at all. And that was the first time where I was kind of like, oh, shit. I thought I'd already... Because there's this thing with child actors where they talk about this notion of sort of bridging that gap between being a child actor and an adult actor. And typically that's... From when you're a child, you get through your teen years, and then when you're in your 20s, you've sort of done that if you're still working.
Right.
So by and large, the narrative was that I'd done that. Like, I'd kind of gotten over that. I was in my 20s, and I was still working. And it sort of didn't... That period of awkwardness didn't really come until I was in my mid to late 20s, where I sort of did have a period about a year where I didn't work. It was interesting, but so humbling and good. Like, I kind of loved the opportunity to sort of reflect and think about where I was in my life and who I was. And it also sort of briefly timed out. Right before I turned 30, I was in therapy for about a year. I'd never been to a therapist, and it was just a really interesting time to sort of be self-reflective and look at the last number of years of my life as I was about to turn 30, to which would be the next chapter of my
sure.
life. And the timing of that worked out beautifully. So all of the things in terms of not being able to work for a period and not quite sure what I was doing all ultimately kind of imbued me with a sense of wanting to understand myself more to then figure out what the next chapter was going to be.
Well, then what...
I mean, good.
Without getting too personal, so that period of time where you're self-reflective and you're in therapy and you're trying to figure who you are, what did you come out with? Like, what did you land on the other side with?
Ultimately, what I found the therapy was so interesting because it was the first time I'd ever done that, and it was definitely never a thing that I was opposed to, but I never felt like I needed it. It all kind of timed out with this thing of starting to be very self-reflective and realizing I suddenly had patterns. Looking at those things, ultimately laughing at myself a shit ton at just the constructs that we make for ourselves, the sort of self-abuse, things that, you know, standards that we create for ourselves that are impossible to reach, mm-hmm. All these little things that were ultimately all a part of me not taking good care of myself. So I figured all those things out, and then just timing-wise, things started to fall into place. And I don't know if it's related necessarily, but I felt better as a human,
yeah.
which ultimately is always the best place to operate from. And then Wilfred came about, and I started DJing more, and I was also starting a production company. So suddenly all these things that I wanted to be doing or that I dreamt about doing, certainly the production company, wanting to get behind movies that I love, and also playing music more, all kind of started to fall into place. And that kind of very clearly defined various paths that would sort of be things I would explore over the next number of years.
Well, there's a lot of stuff still that I want to talk about.
Long answer.
It was, but it was a good answer because it kind of blends, it bleeds really nicely into the idea that, you know, one of the many reasons why I have a lot of respect for what you do is that I love watching people who go, hey, I have a lot of options, but these are the things that I really care about, and these are the things I'm going to pursue. So you're
yeah.
talking about Spectrovision, your company, or you're talking about DJing, or you're talking about taking a project like Wilfred. So I want to get to all that, and I definitely want to talk about horror, but we have to take a quick break. When we come back, our audience members are going to ask some questions. We're going to dig into the questions you guys asked at home. As always, remember, go to @talking on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for exclusive updates about who's going to be on the show, and then you can answer your question asked up here and possibly answered, because no matter who I'm talking to, I want to make sure that you are all a part of the conversation. More with Elijah Wood when we come back on Talking with Chris Hardwick. Welcome back to Talking with Chris Hardwick. My guest is Elijah Wood. Talking Wood, I guess, is the show that we're doing tonight.
Talking Wood.
I think it sounds better than Talking Hardwick, to be honest. Although in the same family.
Talking Hardwood?
Talking
That's
Hardwood.
A different show.
Talking Hardwood is a totally different show.
Different
don't
show.
Google that. You will be sorry you did. But the new film is I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore,
yep.
which won the Sundance Grand Jury Prize. And my wife and I watched the movie the other night, and it is it's on Netflix. And you think it's going to be this kind of quirky comedy between these two characters
yeah.
who sort of find each other. And it gets so fucked up in the movie in such a fantastic way.
It gets really fucked up, yeah.
So how did you get involved, and what was the movie for you?
So Macon Blair, who's the writer, director of the film, he's in it briefly near the beginning of the film. He is in a movie called Blue Ruin and in a movie called Green Room, both directed by Jeremy Saulnier.
Yeah.
Huge, huge fan.
Green Room's great, too, by the way.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
And I just fell in love with Macon and his work, and I met him at a film festival in Austin, Fantastic Fest, that I go
yep.
to every year. And he was like, hey, I've written this thing. Would you care to take a look at it? There's a character that I'm interested in you for. And I was like, holy shit, Macon Blair wants me to read a script that he wrote. I was really excited. So I read the script, and it was the best thing I'd read in so long. It's the movie, if you see it, is very funny. It's also got a lot of heart to it between these two characters that Melanie and I play. And it also kind of devolves into this pretty fucking gnarly genre film. There's all these things kind of working in tandem that worked really well. And I'm just, yeah, I was psyched that it all kind of worked out, that Netflix picked it up, and he got to make the movie that he wanted to make.
But there is this underlying premise, which, and also Melanie Lynskey is such a phenomenal actor. She's so incredible.
Good.
And really nice, too. She's very, very sweet.
Yeah.
But the... But this idea of, I just don't want people to be assholes,
yeah,
is really sort of the through line of
totally
the entire
is.
Movie.
It totally is. I mean, the movie is about her character, Ruth, and her essentially existential crisis of why is the world filled with assholes? Everyone treats people with disrespect, and it's just one thing after another. And it kind of causes a break where she's like, fuck it, I'm going to take things into my own hands, when her laptop and her grandmother's silver are stolen. And she goes on this sort of mission, ultimately, to get her things back. But then it's about, well, no, I'm going to find the perpetrators. And it's so low stakes. It's not about, like, and it's not bringing them to jail. It's not about going to kill them. It's about literally to be able to confront them and be like, you're an asshole, and
yeah,
you shouldn't do that.
Yeah, so you shouldn't do that to people.
Totally. So that's her plan all along. So it's this really tiny, like, crime caper, but with super low stakes.
But the, and you play her neighbor.
I play her neighbor called Tony, who he's a weird dude. He's a weird dude. Yeah, he's got a rat tail.
He's got a rat tail.
Yeah. I grew out my beard for it, of what little I can grow. And he's just he's this guy that is like, and I think we've all met people like this, people that are super into their thing that they're into. It happens to be martial arts for him, mm-hmm, and heavy metal and fantasy novels. So he's kind of a melange of all these things. And he gets, it's that thing of getting a little too psyched to where it kind of puts people off a little bit. And he's probably not, he actually isn't very good at martial arts, but he thinks he is.
Right.
So he's totally accidentally.
He's not afraid to kick people if he feels it's
not
necessary.
At all. Yeah. Not at all. And he's not good. He does successfully kick someone in the film. But it's, there's a lot of heart to him, but he's also kind of isolated, like Ruth is isolated as well, and they kind of worked well together. And it was just fun to play a character that is so different from me and so weird. And
he has a dog funny. Named Kevin, which
That's
is
right.
spectacular.
Yeah.
Dogs with human names.
I love
100%. I had a dog named Scott for many years.
Scott!
Yeah. So I'm very much on board. But, you know, but this feels... Like, I completely understand, like, watching this movie and just knowing what I know of you, I go, this was such a perfect thing for you, because it does
yeah,
ride those lines between silly and then super fucked up,
yeah,
at the same time.
Totally.
I know you, obviously, you're the one who told me about Shudder, which is the on-demand horror service that you can subscribe
yes,
to.
Yes, it's so great.
And it's so great because and I'm not trying to make this a commercial for Shudder, but they curate it so well. Like everything is really like very specific genres of horror, and
totally.
So, you know, what is the darkness that beats within you? Like, what is the draw for you to horror? Because my wife and I watch every horror. Everything.
I know you're a big horror fan too.
Yeah. So what is it for you?
It's such an interesting question. There's actually a documentary called Why Horror that asked that very question, because I don't think it's an easy one to answer. For me, it's a little nostalgic because I grew up with it. So I have a brother that's 7 years older than me, and he would show me movies I wasn't supposed to see. So there's that taboo element of getting to see, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street 3 Dream Warriors when I was six.
Yep.
Or a direct-to-VHS movie called Truth or Dare, which remains one of my favorite films. So I had that, and this kind of thing of the forbidden fruit of getting to see something that I'm not supposed to. And then it stuck with me, I think. I like the feeling of it. There's a sort of tone and an essence to horror that feels good and fun, and it doesn't scare me,
mm-hmm,
but I find the energy around it fun. And I think I like the aesthetics of them. I think they can be oftentimes beautiful. You look at a movie like Suspiria.
Yes.
Suspiria is a beautiful piece of art.
Dario Argento, anyone?
Dario
Argento?
Suspiria is a very good film.
Two people. you should watch the Italian horror.
And I like them for all reasons. I like the psychological aspects of them, where you've got a movie like The Thing, which even though it can get gross, it's ultimately about paranoia, and I mm-hmm love that. But I can also watch a B-grade fucked up thing just because it's super fucked up.
Right.
So I kind of love the spectrum. But I don't know. It's not an easy question to answer.
But Spectrevision, so is Spectrevision wholly focused on horror or just any kind of subsets of genre film?
We started out primarily focused on horror. With the interest, at the time when we started the company, this is about 6 or 7 years ago, we felt, and it was true, there wasn't sort of a company consistently making what we felt was sort of elevated horror genre in the U.S. Most of the films that were being made that we loved at the time were being made in European territories. Things like Let the Right One In,
right.
Or The Orphanage out of Spain.
Right.
Those kinds of films that sort of took the subject matter seriously were more about character than they were about the genre elements. In some ways, we always say the best horror films are the ones where you can take the genre elements out and still have a compelling story.
Oh, that's really.
That there's something at the core
right.
that still drives it. Now we're in the kind of renaissance. Like there are so many companies doing this, but that was our intent. You know, create a space to make these kinds of horror films that are character and story driven, and also push the bounds of what people consider horror to be. That don't play the same notes that we're used to. The problem with horror is it's this weird kind of like degraded stepchild, you know, like it's kind of a malign genre. It's often relegated to the B grade
right.
in terms of people's perception. You know, there's an interview on the Exorcist DVD on the making of with Blatty and Friedkin, where both of them were adamant that The Exorcist is not a horror film. Well, it's unequivocally a horror film.
Sure.
But I think their line of thinking is more of it's not a B grade movie.
Right.
And I think we wanted to change that perception too, and sort of make films that are clearly artful and can be, received as beautiful pieces of work, and they're also in the horror genre.
Well, it's very difficult to navigate the horror genre because it's a genre where there is a potential. I mean, there's sort of a lottery with horror where, you know, it's a genre where you can make something really cheaply. And especially with fucking found footage. Like, if I see another fucking found footage movie...
Fucking done too, dude.
Where you're just like, you would have turned the fucking camera off at that point!
I know.
You know?
There are very few examples of found footage that work.
Have right.
you seen Wreck, R.E.C., the...
Oh, yeah, of course.
That fucking
yeah.
works the whole
that
time.
That works great.
There's always a reason to film.
But like you said, that when they're using it as a device, and I think, we're sort of in the age of Blumhouse now, and Blumhouse is really interesting because... Blumhouse will make some of the best and some of the worst because
yeah.
they're sort of operating on a numbers game.
They are. They're and a machine.
So, yeah. And so, you know, you get some movies where you're like, oh, it's another group of teenagers with a Ouija board. But then you also get, you know, Jordan Peele's Get Out.
Yes,
and so,
which is exceptional.
So you get
this
real balance.
Really
and The Conjuring as well. So they make the amazing movies, but because they're in a numbers game, you get a bunch of them that aren't so great either. But we watch all of them. Are there any right now particularly that you're into?
Well, I thought Get Out was very special. That is an important film, I think. You know, I'll never forget seeing that movie in the theater because that movie is so subversive. You know, it's a movie that is essentially taking, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, sort of, and turning it into a genre film.
And making a statement about our culture. That's a very relevant statement.
Genuinely making a statement about Black culture and our culture.
And elevating the genre at the same time.
It's exceptional.
Yeah.
And to sit in a predominantly white audience and watch white people get killed and people cheer was pure elation. It's pure elation. That was an amazing moment.
Get Out's great. I don't know if you've seen Train to Busan, which
I've not, but I hear that's incredible.
Train to Busan.
It's a zombie movie on a train.
On a train, yeah. Korean,
it's great.
Korean horror. And
I mean, The Witch is still one of my favorite movies in the last few years.
Really? You liked it?
Are you fucking kidding me right now?
Listen.
Are we going to have this
yes,
conversation?
Just a little bit. I'll tell you why.
Okay. I'd love to hear it.
Okay. The Witch, I thought, was a beautiful looking movie. I thought, like, at a certain point, I'm like, fucking something happened for fuck's sake. And then finally at the end, you know, when everything kind of wraps up, I'm like, oh, okay, well, that's it. You know, like, I get...
Have you been... Here's a question, because yeah. I
the arms folded. I see defensive body
no.
posture.
No.
Okay, I see right. rocking motion.
Okay.
All right, let's talk through it.
Well, here's the thing with that film. That movie premiered at Sundance, I
right.
believe.
Was it Sundance or was it South By?
Maybe it was South By. I can't remember. But anyway, there was buzz after the film had premiered.
Sure.
All this buzz about how extraordinary
sure.
this movie was. And by the time I saw a screener of it and then saw it again with an audience at Fantastic Fest, and some of my friends who had built up all of this anticipation for
right.
it were disappointed. And I think that they had assumed or were told that it was the scariest movie of all time, which is not true.
Right.
And that they were expecting some kind of gnarly movie. That it is not.
That's what
I
was expecting.
It is a slow burn character.
Yes, that's what I was expecting. And
I think that hurt people's perceptions.
I didn't not like it.
No, totally.
I really did. I was, you know, from people who, you know, if so many people saw it before I did, like, oh, fuck, this fucking movie. And then I saw it, I'm like, the goat. Okay, all right, you know. But I really did like it.
But it's in the Rosemary's Baby tradition, where
right.
There's not a great deal that happens, but it's tension and this sort of tightening of that tension as the film gets
right.
going. And the ending is so satisfying.
Yeah.
I just, ooh.
That part. It was.
Black Phillip.
Another, just really quickly, another movie, The Girl with All the Gifts, is really great.
I have not seen it yet.
You should see it. It's a fantastic zombie movie. But just like Hall H, we're going to have, this is our fan interaction question of the show, portion of the show. Just like Hall H, we're going to have some folks come up and ask their own questions. So come on up and ask your question. Elijah Wood is here. He is at your disposal. What is your name?
Hi, my name's Katie.
Katie, what is your question for Elijah Wood?
Out of all the projects that you've worked on, what is the most awkward scene you've had to film?
Ooh, good question.
That did not involve farting.
Most awkward. I had to make out with Christina Ricci at the bottom of a pool for a movie called The Ice Storm. And my mother was present watching that. And it wasn't like make out in a kind of traditional way. It was like two people that didn't know what they were doing sticking their tongues as far down their throats as possible. So that was pretty awkward.
Yeah, The Ice Storm was a huge... I mean, I would imagine that movie was a turning point for you as well.
Big turning point, yeah.
Because that was a critical and commercial success.
Yeah, and it was also, for me as an actor, it put me into work and material that I'd never experienced before. It felt really challenging and more adult than a lot of the films that I'd been a part of before. And to get a chance to work with Ang Lee was so exceptional, and that cast, and the work that we did leading up to it. We all got these packets of information on the 1970s to sort of familiarize ourselves with the era. Mm-hmm. Q&As for each character fill out about our relationships to our siblings, to who we are as humans, and then we read them aloud to Ang and to each other. It was just a really involved creative process that was unlike anything I'd experienced.
I have a special treat for you. I'd have to pull my pants down. Like these are like dress yoga pants. It's just otherwise they just ride up. Hey kids, hey, your old grandpa's got some candies for you. Sorry. I have very special. These are signed by Elijah, which so you will always see those. We have a video question roll in. Let's roll it.
Hi, Chris and Elijah. This is Lucy from Sydney, Australia. I've been a big fan of Lord of the Rings since I was 9 years old. My question is, if you could play any superhero, which superhero would you pick and why?
Superhero, who would you be?
Oh, God. Thanks for that question, Lucy. Is it Lucy? Lucy?
It was Lucy?
Lucy.
Lucy from Australia?
Yeah.
Lucy.
fuck. I don't know. That's a tough question.
Are you more of a... Because you said you didn't really read comic books growing up.
Not really.
What kind of powers do you... Like, you must have the superhero dream. Like, I always dream... I would have thought I'd want the Superman dream. I always have the Spider-Man dream. I'm always climbing up walls and shooting shit out of my... Yeah,
I always have that. That's pretty awesome.
What about you?
Flying dreams.
You have flying dreams.
Yeah, flying dreams. I don't know. Superhero... why am I forgetting the name of it?
Superman?
No.
Okay.
No, one of the greatest graphic novels of all time.
Watchmen?
The Watchmen.
Right.
So it would probably be Rorschach.
Rorschach.
I just think The Watchmen is incredible, and I love that character. But I'm not a big superhero fan. I was always... Batman was always my favorite because he didn't have superpowers.
Right.
And he was a terribly conflicted individual. and that just made him interesting.
Not as played by George Clooney. He was super like, hey, everybody, I'm Batman.
That is true.
I was at New York Comic Con one year, and he was on a panel.
Uh-huh.
And without really catching myself, I go, hey, sweet Bruce Wayne cosplay to George Clooney. And in front of everyone, and I was like, oh, what did I just say? And he stopped for a second and goes, hey, everyone,
I just want to apologize for that, just so you guys know. Like, he apologized for his Bruce Wayne all the New York Comic Con audience. We have time for another question from the audience, if anyone else wants to get up. Hey, what is your name and what is your question?
Hello.
I'm Tyra, and when shooting Wilfred, how did you get used to shooting with a man in a dog costume?
It's weird how quickly that I took that for granted. Kind of like my character, I sort of immediately got super used to it, like it became a new normal. What became difficult over time was just trying not to laugh, because Jason Gann is so fucking funny, and the things that he would come up with on a daily basis were so ridiculous and amazing, and always so different and surprising. So that was the biggest challenge. But yeah, I got real used to seeing him in a dog costume.
I have a special present.
To where it was weird seeing him out of it.
This is a very special present for you. You can see Elijah signed that on the side there. There's a drawing board for you. Let's take another video question.
Hey guys, Benny Blanco from the Bronx here. Would you consider doing a musical, since you like both acting and music?
Would you consider doing a musical?
I would. I would. I don't know if I've got a great singing voice. I think it's kind of fine.
Have you auditioned for one?
I have auditioned for one. I auditioned for Moulin Rouge.
Did you really?
Which was so crazy, because the audition is singing, and I'd never experienced that before. So I actually took voice lessons for like a week or two before the audition, and I think I did some classic like Sondheim song. I can't remember what it was. Embraceable You. And, like, the audition was a mix of performing as an actor, like a scene, and then two songs. And I had to, like, sing and dance.
Oh, wow.
I definitely didn't get it, obviously.
When you were doing it...
I was terrified.
Did you feel weird about it when it was happening, or did you feel...
I fully committed. Because I think in that moment, if you feel awkward, like, it'll show and it's just all going to... be pear-shaped, but
that's what you got to do, right?
You have to. You have to. You just have to go for it. Exactly.
Yeah, and
so
not
I just
be afraid.
Went full musical on that shit.
Let's take a few card questions really quickly. This is from at Hanya Saad on Twitter. How often do people ask you to be the ring bearer at their wedding?
I was once.
What?
I was once. Someone got married in the Alamo Drafthouse Theater in Austin, Texas. And I can't remember, I think it was during Buttonumathon. Have you ever heard of Buttonumathon?
I've heard of Buttonumathon, yeah.
It's a great 24-hour film festival that Harry Knowles of Ain't It Cool News programs.
I know Harry, yeah, great. Yeah. It's great.
It's awesome. So two people who I think had met at Buttonumathon got married at Buttonumathon, and I was the ring bearer. they literally, I think it was a whole planned thing, and they were like, does anybody have a ring? And I, you know. It was great. I definitely have had that question before, not from friends or anything, but definitely from other people, like fans, I suppose. But yeah,
excellent.
I got to do it.
Brandon, do you want more card questions, or should we go to?
What does the voice say?
The voice.
The voice says, "Set fire to all of you." No. Must obey the voice.
Before we go to break, I want to let you guys know the extended uncut version of this chat is available as a Nerdist podcast. So that's the plan.
No!
Yes! So the people can watch a TV show, they kind of get the edited visual version of the thing, and then
Dude.
We're just going to put out the unedited audio as a Nerdist podcast.
And they can hear us curse and
They
shit.
Can hear us say everything. They can hear you make your filthy little talks there, you naughty young man. So please fucking go to amc.com/talking for bonus clips, exclusive content, and links to the podcast for every one of the episodes. More with Elijah Wood in a moment. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Talking with Chris Hardwick. I am Chris Hardwick of the Chris Hardwick and Talking with Chris Hardwick. Let's take some more viewer questions. I'm never going to get used to saying my name in the third person. Let's just a few kind of rapid fire questions. My Chemical Dad on Instagram, do you have a favorite meme?
Ooh, a favorite meme?
Yeah.
No, I don't think I do.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
That's a fair answer.
Shit.
That's a fair answer. Suck
like
it, my
down.
Chemical Dad. Oh, the poor guy. Angkor on Instagram says, what is your favorite video game to waste time with?
For wasting time, probably GTA 5.
Nice.
Or, yeah.
Nice. And then Dream Beans on Reddit. Surprise, you've just won front seat ticket to the most amazing concert of all time. Which concert do you choose?
Oh, God. Probably Nirvana during the In Utero tour.
Oh, yeah, good
one. I miss seeing Nirvana.
Good. You kids don't remember Nirvana. They smelled like Teen Spirit, and we liked it that way. This one's quick and easy. McKay Smith on Twitter. Hey, dude, I have a strange question. I'm wondering if you would send me a picture of you flipping the camera off. Do you want to just flip off this camera?
This one right here?
Yeah, sure. Get a close-up on that. There we go. That might become a meme. Great. Perfect. Everybody turned down. Was there iconic roles? Run in front seat ticket. Dude, it's a strange question. Oh, Caitlin Smith won on Instagram. If you could go back and do something differently in any film, what would it be?
Ooh. If I could go back and do something differently in any film, I don't know. That's a really good question.
I guess it just means you are perfect.
No. I don't know.
Do you watch things that way? Though some people don't watch things that way. Like sometimes, are you the type of person that when you're done, you're like, well, that's what that was, and I'm moving on to the next thing?
Kind of. Yeah, I don't get overly critical. And ultimately, when I see something for the first time that I've worked on, I'm not really looking at myself. I'm looking at the whole thing and how the whole thing came together.
Yeah.
I don't kind of micromanage my own performance or critique it in that way. I certainly am critical of my work, but I don't get overly kind of caught up in it. So yeah, I think once something's done and I can sort of acknowledge like, yeah, yay or nay, if I feel good or bad about it, but that's sort of it.
We have time for another question from the audience. What is your name and what is your question?
Hi, my name is Sarah.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. The audience was appreciating you too much. What's your name?
My name is Sarah.
Sarah, welcome. Hi.
My question. Oh, thank you. My question for you is, since you filmed The Lord of the Rings on location in New Zealand, what was the hardest or even scariest part of shooting there for you?
Ooh, well, the hardest part was probably just endurance. Long hours, long days, 6-day weeks, just trying to kind of get used to that amount of work and not getting a lot of rest. That was probably the hardest part of it. And the scariest? I mean, I don't know. There was nothing ever really truly frightening, but we went to some wild locations that, were on tops of mountains and things like that were, I suppose, treacherous to some. But I was never scared. It was always super exciting because we got to sort of have these experiences that were so far beyond anything that we'd ever done before and flying things in helicopters. And I loved it. Sean Astin was really nervous, though. I remember one day he was always so concerned about safety, even though they had it under control. Because, they think about those things in pre-production. I remember one day there were, we had like four different helicopters that were each landing and like dropping people off and picking them up to take them to a location or back from a location. And so there was a sort of row of like four different helicopters, and he got out of the one that had transported him, and he sort of stands there and he's like pointing to the guy like, can you see you've got helicopters behind you? And it's like, yeah, no shit, dude. He knows. Like, thanks for helping. Sorry, Sean.
I have a very special present.
It was very funny.
I have a very special present for you. This is some Lord of the Rings script pages signed by Elijah Wood. Thank you very much, Sarah.
You're welcome.
And then, he didn't really have a question, but I got it. This guy made a shirt. You got to stand up
That's
and show
great.
The shirt. Come here. Can you look at the shirt? Look at this shirt here. So this is a picture of me, and then this is
That's been superimposed.
Yeah, with a picture of you.
Yeah, and I remember I was at some kind of convention, and this girl asked if I would hop on her back, and I was like, yeah, I'll buy
it. Well, I have a very special thing for you. I'm going to give you...
Yeah, you get the rat tail!
Great. Well, I have something for you guys. I actually made you guys shirts of this as well.
No way.
You did?
Yes.
You made this? Give me my present! Give me!
Oh, dude, that's amazing.
Oh, my God, he made these shirts for us.
Thank you so much.
I can't believe I'm legitimately going to wear this. What is your name?
Adam,
thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
This is fantastic.
Wow.
Before we...
I think I know how we're going to end the show, by the way. I think I know how we're going to end the show.
A bit of foreshadowing.
Maybe a little bit. But before we go, as we're kind of wrapping this up, and I want to thank you so much for all of your time and insight and also just for being a good guy that I've gotten to know these past few years.
Thanks.
Do you have any sort of parting wisdom for people? Like, you know, now that you're 36, you've been in the business for a while, you know, as someone who's done really well, followed their passions, done so successfully, you know, what do you say to people who maybe, and it's not like acting advice, just any kind of creator?
Oh, man. I don't know. The thing that's become more important to me the older I get is, it's very simple, but integrity. The choices that we make, the reasons why we're making the choices that we're making, and that can apply to anything. Not doing something simply because you think of what it's going to get you or how it's going to elevate you, but rather what at the core of the thing that you're doing do you connect with? How does it connect to you, irregardless of whether or not it's something that will be digested by people or will make you famous or all these sort of ancillary things that come along with artistic endeavors, but how does it connect to your soul? That's what you should follow, not anything else. And so integrity is the most important thing, making those choices based on a heart response and a purity of the love of the thing that it is that you're doing. Because I think you'll tend to head down the wrong path if ultimately the thing that you're trying to achieve is for the wrong reasons. You know, it's not about fulfilling yourself internally, but rather the sort of artifice of the bullshit associated with, you know, various artistic endeavors.
Elijah Wood, I want to thank you so much for being here, being my guest today on the first episode of Talking with Chris Hardwick. Would it violate your integrity if we ended the show recreating this pose?
I knew this was going to happen.
Yeah.
And you're doing, like, the space
I'm doing
flying
the thing out. Yeah, so... okay, ready?
So check us out at Talking on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Find out who's going to be on the show, how you can be a part of it. I'm going to give this to you. Thank you so much. I'm Chris Hardwick at Hardwick. Good night. We'll see you soon.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
I feel like I was blindsided.
Because it's a competition show.
From the producers of Jury Duty and The Bachelor.
We have scoured the earth for the 14 greatest reality contestants that were available during our production window.
Comes a reality competition show about reality competition shows.
Nobody has dared to find out who is the actual best at just being on a reality show. I'm your host, comedian Daniel Tosh.
Is win or go home.
Each episode, our contestants will face new challenges that will test their strength and lack of life skills for a chance to win $200
million.
$200,000.
Prepare, because it's about to be ugly, crying.
Lots of fighting.
Tayshia, I have to defend myself.
Celebrating 25 years of reality TV with your favorites.
I have diarrhea. You cannot do this to me.
What in gay hell have I got myself into?
The GOAT, premiering on Freevee and Prime Video on May 9th.